In the oppressive kitchens of 17th century Italy, where desperation mingled with the aroma of simmering pots, one woman brewed a recipe for liberation. Come along as we explore a silent revolution. A revolution that would free over 600 women from the abuse they suffered at the hands of those who should have protected them. Welcome to As We Eat, where we explore the intersection of food, family, history, and culture.
We think there's something magical that happens when people get together and share food. Conversations seem to happen a little more naturally. We talk about our commonalities and our differences. We share stories, memories, and recipes.
And we'll use food to take a journey that explores our human experience. Share some fun facts and some that aren't so fun. Talk about food history and how food connects and defines us.
So if you've ever eaten, prepared, or shared food, then this podcast probably has something for you.
Hey, it's Leigh, and I'm actually flying solo this week. Our lovely Kim is dealing with a death in the family, and I am sure that she would appreciate all of the good thoughts and vibes that you can send her and her family as they navigate through this season in life. So I will be taking you on this journey of deadly liberation. You know, when we were researching stories for our season of Food and Crime, there were a couple stories that we felt were really appropriate for Women's History Month. Now, to clarify, we don't necessarily condone the actions that these women took in the stories that we're going to be telling you this month, but we're also not in any position to judge their actions. Now, I'd like to start by setting the stage when this story took place. Imagine 17th century Italy, a time of opulent courts, grand cathedrals, strict social norms, a time of change when the Renaissance gave way to the Baroque era, where contrast, motion, grandeur, reverence, and awe were characterized in art, and the idea of absolute rulers, hierarchical, and patriarchal society were further bolstered. Images of religious works appeared once again, encouraging piety and the awe of the church. A time where your station in life was defined by your class. A time when women were classless. Now, the internet will tell you that they were defined as second-class citizens. But you tell me if this sounds remotely second. Women were possessions of their husbands. They were expected to be chaste, silent, and confined to the household. They were required to uphold the strictest codes of conduct and be virtuous, even when their husbands were not, and they were not a lot. They were not in line for inheritance, and even if they were abused, which happened more often than not, they had no legal recourse. They were subjected to their fathers from birth and treated as chattel when handed over to their husbands. The prevailing thought of the day was that women were born to serve men. Being a wife was the only vocation that was truly virtuous. Being a good wife, that is. And there was plenty of rhetoric to define a good wife. The marriage would protect, and please note how loosely I use that word, a woman from falling into a second vocation available to women at the time, that of becoming a sex worker. There was, however, a third option, at least for upper-class women, that would afford some freedom: becoming a widow. In addition to cooking and cleaning, running a household required some skill in medicines and potions. Women often created tinctures and decoctions to treat sore throats, headaches, fever, indigestion, melancholy, and trapped wind, as well as beauty treatments for face creams made from tallow to rouge for lips and cheeks. This is likely how our heroine, to some, devious serial killer to others, Julia Tofana, was introduced to the skill of potion cream and cosmetic making. We know very little of Julia's early life, other than she was born in Palermo around 1620, and that's even in dispute. She was orphaned at the age of 13 when her mother was executed for the alleged murder of her father. Julia did have a daughter, who the father was is lost to time, as well as if Julia was ever married. And if so, what happened to her husband? Julia and her daughter moved around Italy, ending up in Rome, where Julia built quite a significant customer base for her potions, remedies, and creams. But her most popular product was a complexion aid called Acqua Tofana, purported to mask blemishes and smooth imperfections. I suppose an abusive husband could be considered a blemish and imperfect by his victim. At any rate, the potion, made from arsenic, lead, and belladonna, was packaged to look like a cosmetic powder or bottled in a devotional vial embellished with the image of Saint Nicholas, ironically, the patron saint of unmarried people. As the story goes, Julia kept a fairly low profile, only taking on Acqua Tofana clients who were referred to her by previous satisfied customers. She would instruct her client to lace the husband's wine or soup with one drop of Acqua Tofana for 4 days. The first and second doses would bring on symptoms that looked a lot like a cold. The third dose would induce vomiting, diarrhea, a burning sensation that was similar to heartburn. And the fourth dose would see the woman freed from her abuser. Julia's success could be counted in the number of marriage resolutions in which she and her loyal staff assisted. Currently, historians believe that that number is around 600. And again, although I understand that murder is not the best path, it is significant in demonstrating the lengths that these women were willing to go in order to be granted the freedom from abuse and domination. Unfortunately, there was one woman who didn't have the fortitude to carry through with the dosage plan. I imagine a timid, tired, and insecure woman placing one drop of Acqua Tofana in her husband's minestrone soup, tentatively watching as his spoon dips into the dish, wondering what it'll be like without this brute running her life, and as quickly slipping back into the belief that this is her lot in life. This is what she deserves. This is what all women were born to. Who is she to think that she could live without him? How would she live without him? She has no skill other than making a home. Would she have to resort to sex work or living the rest of her life out as a nun? And she swiftly removes the bowl from him, spilling the spoonful onto his lap. He stands, quickly grabbing her, demanding to know how she could be so impertinent. And fear consumes her, and she tells all. How she went to the apothecary to get the poison. How she was to put a drop in his wine or soup for 4 days. And ultimately be rid of him, but that she just couldn't. She couldn't follow through with it. Whether it was from the ingrained beliefs, the fear of being caught, or the fear of committing a crime, we'll never know. And we'll never know what became of this scared, abused woman. But as the story goes, we do know that this set into motion the demise of Julia Tofana. As word got out that Julia's secret, and ultimately the secret of 600 other women, had been found out, these women helped her seek sanctuary in a local church. But as rumors circulated that she was bound to poison Rome's entire water system, the local police stormed the church, taking Julia into custody. She confessed to providing 600 wives with potion to rid them of their husbands, only after being brutally tortured. Now let's keep in mind that arsenic was not only used in cosmetics, but it was also used in medicines and remedies at this time. So is it possible that these abused women, who likely were skilled at making home remedies, saw a solution right there in their beauty products and acted on their own? It's probable. It's possible. Could the confession have been Julia's desperate attempt to stop the brutalization at the hands of her inquisitors? Also possible and probable. In the end, Julia, her daughter, and the staff were hanged for their crime. Now, if we believe she truly was guilty, can she be considered a heroine for providing a solution to women with no recourse for the crimes that society had dealt them, and ultimately challenging social norms and an advocate for justice? Or simply a vengeful serial killer whose actions were no better than her victims? If you're just joining us for our food and crime adventure, might we suggest that you go back to the start with episode 77, Layers of Deceit, A Recipe for Murder, and episode 78, Love's Toxic Triangle, The Chocolate Cream Killer's Poisonous Obsession, where we introduce you to two more lady poisoners and ask some poignant questions about guilt, why chocolate's a perfect food to deliver poison, and the definition of insanity. Join us again in 2 weeks as we regale you with another story of a woman next door. A woman made popular through her fortune-telling, love potions, and family planning, of sorts. And we want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule and allow us to, hopefully, entertain you with the stories of the intersection of food and crime. For more information about today's episode, check out our website at asweeat.com, follow us on Instagram at asweeat, and join our Family Recipes, Traditions, and Food Lore community on Facebook. And so you don't miss an episode, subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And if you could spare a couple of minutes away from that minestrone soup and rate the podcast on Apple Podcast, Podchaser, or Spotify, we would be ever so appreciative. This simple act really is a huge help in helping us to reach more food enthusiasts like you. We also publish the As We Eat Journal on Substack, and we would be honored if you would support us by becoming a subscriber. You can choose a free subscription, or if you'd like to support us financially, we have a couple of options as well. You can find the journal at asweeat.substack.com. You've been listening to the As We Eat podcast, part of our curiosity-driven project, serving up how food connects, defines, inspires, sometimes gets you hanged, by blending a bit of research with a dash of humor and a whole lot of passion.